Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Everybody, we got a great one today, you know, for a change. And this time I'm not lying. The brilliant Anne Applebaum of the Atlantic Monthly is with me from Poland, where she makes her home. And I could not have a better human being to walk us through where the war in Ukraine stands and where it is going and why it's going to be a long war. Because Anne explains what this is, which she says is genocide, which surprised me. I had always thought of genocide as, you know, Hitler and the Jews and some other instances throughout history where people are targeted. But Anne says that's what this is, that Putin wants to destroy Ukraine and doesn't see it as a real country and wants to wipe it off the map. And she points to what the Russians have done when they have occupied a piece of territory in Ukraine, which is round up and torture and kill people who speak Ukrainian and ship Ukrainian children to Russia and make them Russian. And this is why Ukraine will fight this war to the end, unless the toll in Russia just becomes intolerable and Putin is forced to the table. But even then, would the Ukrainians just see that as a pause before he can regroup and start up again? So there aren't a lot of laughs in this one, actually a few, but I gotta say Anne is amazing and you have to listen to this one. That's why I'm going to make this a relatively short monologue to get right to Anne. But just one last thing about Anne and this episode: among other things, Anne is an expert on besides global politics, on fake news, and we go into the history of fake news. And of course there's always been propaganda and Stalin and Hitler and Father Coughlin, all using the radio, etc. But Anne talks us through how Putin played a big role in creating fake news as we know it today. When he was in the KGB in the early 80s, they created an international rumor that the CIA had invented AIDS. I think I remember that. And they planted it first in an Indian newspaper and then an Italian newspaper. And in a lot of different places all over the world, and they created some fake scientists who gave a fake press conference and spread the rumor in Malaysia and in Africa. And this, of course, was all pre-internet. Now, of course, you spread fake news instantaneously all over the world on the internet through social media and the dark web and with thousands and thousands and thousands of bots. Hey, so this is a dark one, but I have to say, Anne, who joins me here for the second time, instantly joins the pantheon of the greatest Al Franken podcast guests of all time, along with Heather McGee, Dahlia Lithwick, Frank Foer, and Norm Ornstein, although I might have to drop Norm to make room for Anne, because this is not just a great one. It may be the best single podcast I have ever done. Oh, and Hunter Biden got indicted, which is bad for Joe Biden, because it reminds people that he has a 53-year-old son. Anyway, listen to this one with the amazing Anne Applebaum. It is a great one, you know, for a change.
Moto Casino, America
social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Ann writes for the Atlantic Monthly, and I'm always looking for your stuff, and I missed your piece on Elon Musk somehow. Now, he, of course, has these satellites, the Starlink system, and was providing Ukraine with a lot of help in the war, right?
Yeah, more than that. You know, what happened was is that at the very beginning of the war, the Russians essentially took out the Ukrainian internet. And there was an emergency. People said, what can we do? And someone said, let's use Starlink. It's relatively cheap. You can do it fast. You can set it up with these little, you have these little pods that you can distribute to people, and everyone can start using them. And everyone distributed Starlink. Starlink became the Ukrainian internet. And nobody really thought about what, therefore, was the role of Elon Musk, who is the private owner of this
right.
system and who can make decisions about it. And normally, of course, when you know, the Defense Department buys a weapon or a system or something, there's a kind of Chinese wall between the producer and them. And so they decide how it's being used. But this was this was an emergency, and therefore he had some say over.
If you make a missile for the U.S., you don't each time they use it have to approve it. This is if the U.S. buys one, this is different. This is he owns this thing, right?
He owns the system, he owns the satellites, and he was, you know, initially, I think it's now, the system has now changed, he was therefore able to make some decisions about it. And infamously, and actually this story has been known for a while, in September of 2022, the Ukrainians had put together a fleet of sea drones, which at that time nobody knew about. I've just been to see them, which I can tell you about it. They're very, very cool.
What are sea drones?
Sea drones. There are different kinds. The ones that I saw are little mini boats. They look like little black boats. I mean, funny enough.
Hence, S-E-A.
Yes. C as in the water. Yes.
Yes. Okay. I got
C as in the water. These are water drones. There are also some little, there are submarine drones too, but these are actually unmanned boats or something. And they're little black boats. They're about the size of like a paddle boat. But they have explosives. And they also have very, very sophisticated communications equipment attached to them. So you can guide them, you can navigate them, you can, they have little cameras, you can see where they're going. They were custom designed by Ukrainian engineers who began working on them after the war broke out. And the first time they were tried to use them was in September 2022. And they aimed them at the port of Sebastopol, which is, it's part of Crimea, and it's where Russia keeps its Black Sea fleet. On the way to Crimea, suddenly the satellite connection stopped working. And there was a kind of panicky moment where the Ukrainians and some people not in Ukraine, actually some Americans, started calling up Musk and saying, could you please turn it on fast? You know, they're in the middle of an operation. And Musk refused. And there's a discrepancy about whether he actually turned it off or whether it hadn't been turned on. And there are people who have different versions of that, actually. But in any case, it didn't happen. The operation was aborted. And some of the drones made it back home, actually. Some didn't. But this was the first time that Musk actually interfered in a Ukrainian operation.
So, and that was over a year. That was a year ago.
It was then noticed a few other times on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine that sometimes the soldiers would find their links dropped out. And it seems that Musk had kind of limited Starlink to the front line rather than to the borders of Ukraine. And so when they were in retaking territory, they would run into problems. Essentially, what happened is this was fixed and the Defense Department gave them different communication system. And now I think Starlink itself is partly been given over to the U.S., to the Pentagon as well. And so this problem is gone. But in any case, the punchline, and this is the thing I didn't know until last weekend. I was in Kyiv last weekend and I have a friend who is involved in the drone production business. Who took me to see the sea drones and to talk to the people who make them. And I didn't know, you know, exactly who I would be meeting and so on. In fact, I can't say their names or anything about them. But they said to me, well, one of them said, well, actually, I was involved in that operation that Musk aborted.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran it again in October, a month later, and we hit several ships. So in other words, Musk had stopped the operation on the grounds that, I suppose this is, we should have said as well, he stopped it on the grounds that it would cause World War III, because he had just spoken to the Russian ambassador. He claimed later on that he'd spoken to Putin, then he denied that he'd spoken to Putin. I don't know who he spoke to, but he spoke to some Russians. And they said, this is a very dangerous operation. If the Ukrainians hit, you know, Crimea, then we will nuke them, essentially. However, this isn't true. That's not what happened, because they did hit the ship.
They did hit him and he didn't launch him. And he's been threatening this from the beginning, pretty much the beginning of the war. And that slowed our providing sophisticated equipment to Ukraine throughout the war. And every time he made that threat, we got nervous and didn't provide sophisticated weapons that we could have at that time. But You don't want to start World War III.
Yeah, that's exactly, you know, but actually it goes back farther than that. So in 2014, when the Russians invaded Crimea the first time, the Ukrainians were told, don't fight back. It was a chaotic moment, and the president had just escaped the country, and it was complicated for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But they didn't fight in Crimea. The result of that was that after they occupied Crimea, the Russians invaded eastern Ukraine. And then the Ukrainians did fight back, and the Russians took some territory, but they stopped. The point being that when you fight back, they stop.
That's the period when we were when Trump was withholding some military stuff to try to get Zelensky to say something about release stuff. About
that was a bit later, but in between 2014 and 2022, we gave them very little, and as you say, at one point, the Congress passed a resolution saying we should give them some weapons, and Trump tried to blackmail Zelensky, saying, I'll give you the weapons if you give me some made-up stuff about Joe Biden.
That was the first impeachment.
Yes. So all this is all connected. But the point is they have, you know, we have been, we, speaking broadly, I mean, not just Musk, but many people have been intimidated by this fear, nuclear fear, which the Russians play up all the time. They show nuclear explosions on television. They talk about it all the time. They warn about it all the time. And the idea is to get us not to help Ukraine. But the lesson that we've learned over the last several years, and particularly over the last 18 months, is that when we do push back, when the Ukrainians do fight back, the Russians step back. And so what was the result of them hitting the Black Sea port in October 2022, the result was that the ships all stayed in the port for the next month because they were scared of the drones. So they were not able to go out. They were not able to launch missiles at Ukraine, you know, at Ukrainian cities. The drones have been an effective deterrent of the Russians. Every time we, you know, we stand up to the Russians, the Ukrainians stand up to the Russians, rather, there is a deterrent effect and they step back. So Musk was, he fell for this kind of Russian scare tactics, and he intervened in an operation that he had no business intervening in. It turned out that was a mistake. So the there are sort of several things going on here. One is, what right does Musk have to make these decisions? And the second one is, didn't we all make a mistake by believing this propaganda and being afraid?
And now we don't believe it because he's cried wolf too many times.
He's cried wolf a lot of times. I mean, you know, there is some possibility that he will use nuclear weapons. Putin will.
And that would be like a tactical nuke. But if he does that, then he's a worldwide pariah,
right.
I think.
So there are a lot of...
Which I want to ask you about. I want to ask you about what he's doing in terms of building alliances with countries that aren't the West. Like, you know, obviously China and North Korea, but also like India and Brazil and other countries like that. Like how he's turned to doing that and fighting the West in that way.
Yes, that is part of his tactic. So he is trying to create a kind of alternative alliance of autocracies or countries that don't identify with the West or with the US. I would say it's been a mixed success. So it's true that he now sells his oil to India and to China. It's less clear that he's getting weapons from any of them. Certainly the Indians don't seem to be giving him any weapons.
It's like Iran and North Korea.
Korea. And even China officially, there's an argument about whether some Chinese components are getting to him, you know, but it doesn't look like the Chinese are helping him in some massive way either. The Chinese don't seem to like the war. And in fact, just to the previous point, the Chinese have said out loud several times, this must not become a nuclear conflict. And they seem to be not keen on that at all. And that's one of the big pressures on Putin, other than the fact that we would respond somehow, which we've also said to him.
I would think everyone in the world would think that, because once that happens, we don't know what happens next. And also, any nuke will put radioactivity into the atmosphere world. And
yes, and the wind blows to the east in that part of the world, and you know, the radioactivity will spread into Russia. So there are significant numbers of reasons why it would not make sense for him to do it. But yes, he is absolutely aggressively seeking to create this alternative alliance. And I would say definitely Iran and North Korea are in. I suppose Venezuela is in and Cuba is in.
To what extent, you said that China might be sending some parts or stuff that he can. To what extent has Putin been able to successfully start rebuilding missiles and stuff like that because of getting components and things like that from the rest of, from those countries?
So I'm not sure that we know with any precision, but it seems he's been able to do some of that, but not in large quantities. And I mean, there was somebody, I was in Kyiv last weekend, somebody told me that over the summer, there was a missile that fell somewhere in Ukraine that they, you know, they took apart and identified, and they realized it had been made very recently. But that also implied that they're making stuff and rushing it to the front line because they, you know, they've run out of stuff. So it's not like they have these huge stockpiles anymore. And it's not clear that they're able to replace, you know, what they used to have very quickly.
Well, this goes to my big question is, how has the counteroffensive gone and where are we in the war?
The counteroffensive has gone slower than many had hoped. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons was that it took longer than expected for the Ukrainians to get all the weapons they were promised. So again, we had this problem of things being slow. You know, the US and Germany Germany had a lot of tanks that it could have given to Ukraine and made a very late decision to donate.
And Poland was in the front of getting stuff.
Poland got stuff to Ukraine very fast. I mean, some of it was old Soviet stuff, and the Poles are now buying weapons like crazy. So Poland had limited, you know, actually it was the Germans who had these large numbers of modern tanks.
And they had given Poland some of them, and Poland said, we'll give them to Ukraine.
There's something like that, yes.
Now, for my audience, just for geography, Poland has a big, long border, and it's sort of the whole of southeast Poland borders Ukraine. So the Poles are in on this whole hog, right?
I mean, the Poles perceive this as, you know, the conflict, because if Putin had won in Ukraine the way he expected to win and had taken it over quickly and so on, they reckon they would have been next. So there's that, you know, there's that aspect of it. There was also a thing that happened here in Poland, you know, with the first couple of days after the war broke out, there was a kind of national shudder, you know, because even the photographs looked like September 1939, which is when Poland was simultaneously invaded by Germany and the Soviet Union. And even the pictures, you know, of the women at the train stations looked like pictures that were familiar to people. So there was this huge public reaction saying, we have to do something. People drove their cars to the border to pick up refugees. You know, everyone I know had refugees.
How many refugees are Ukrainian refugees are in Poland right now?
So quite a lot of them. There were a lot who came over the border. I mean, several million. I don't know that there's an accurate number now. A lot of them either moved on to other European countries or went back. Every time I've taken the train back to Ukraine, it's been full of people going home. Because you can actually now live in Western Ukraine or Kyiv, and most of the time it's pretty normal. The number is probably something like a million, but they're also, you know, it's not as if they're refugee camps. I mean, they work, you know, they work on construction sites or they work in shops. I mean, they're integrated into the economy, and I'm constantly meeting Ukrainians. I mean, they're driving taxis or they're running small businesses. So there are a lot of them are part of the economy now rather than some kind of group that stands out. There is a little bit of resentment of them. There is a little bit of scratchiness now between Ukraine and Poland. There's some arguments about Ukrainian grain exports, which are cheaper than Polish grain, something like that. And we have a nationalist government here, which is trying to use some of that xenophobic energy to help them win an election campaign. So there's a bit of that around right now. But as I said, overall, the policy remains very strongly pro-Ukraine, very strongly pro-NATO, very much. I mean, most of the U.S. equipment comes through Poland. And there are, of course, U.S. troops in Poland now for the first time ever in world history. So there is the war is present here in a way it's not in the U.S.
Part of the reason that the counteroffensive was slower was the Russians had really dug in, right? And were able to mine the place. Is that because it was slower in developing and that gave them the time and tank traps and all that stuff?
Yeah. So to give you an idea, I mean, this is probably the largest minefield any army has ever tried to cross. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands of mines over hundreds of square kilometers. It's this huge obstacle. And the Ukrainians tried in June to, they have this equipment, they have these new tanks and so on, and they made one attempt to cross it with a big group, and they realized it couldn't be done. You know, you would cross it, you would demine some area, and by the time you got the tanks into place, you know, the Russians would have identified where it was the area that you'd cleared, and they would hit you. So they started fighting in a different way, and they essentially, they fight with infantry. They have guys on foot, sappers who demine territory, and then they have infantry come in, and very slowly doing that, they have taken back some territory, both in the northeast of the country, and then some in the south. I mean, they've made enough progress so that they're able now pretty much to hit almost every area of the occupied territories, and they continue destroying Russian logistics. I mean, every day something explodes, and somebody sends around a YouTube video of it, and they have moved forward. I mean, I think some had hoped for more progress by the end of the summer, but you know, it was not to be. Maybe by the end of the year, by the end of the fighting season, there'll be something more. And people, you know, there are different scenarios, and people hope for more. But it does now look like it will take longer than it was expected.
So, that brings us to the subject of a long war, and what does that mean?
I don't know how long it can go on. You know, the Russians are now, I was given a figure, something like 40% of their budget is now weapons and recruiting and pushing people to the front line. You know, they have real labor shortages now because of all the people who've been called up.
How do they recruit when you say recruiting?
Recruit is the wrong word. Sorry, mobilize. 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 And
because I can imagine recruiting posters for this war. And
come get shot up in Bakhmut. You know, not very appealing. But I mean, they were fighting with convicts earlier in the war. So,
well, of course, Prigozhin used them. And how's he do? Oh.
He's dead.
Yeah. That was a, well, you laugh, you know.
But well, it was, you know, I mean, how
a miscalculation, do you think, that Prigozhin made in terms of, I never understood when you're marching toward Moscow and then you say, oh, and then you meet with him and go like, okay. I mean, how does that work? In other words, what was going through Prigozhin's mind?
So it's pretty clear that he expected more support.
And he wasn't going to get it, and then he bailed.
Yes. I mean, he did walk into the city of Rostov and into the military headquarters there, which is the main military headquarters from which the war is being run. He walked in, he parked his armored cars outside.
Right.
No one stopped him. He announced that he was staging rebellion. Putin went on television and said, you know, this is like 1917 and I'm like Tsar Nicholas II and, you know, we mustn't let this civil war break out. Then he started marching to Moscow, where he also had very little opposition. You know, they just drove their military vehicles down the highway. And they got quite close. I mean, they got within something like 100 miles of Moscow. The city of Moscow panicked. They started building barriers outside of the city, and people were told to stay home and so on. He got pretty far, without anybody objecting to it. And my guess is that he expected something more, though. He thought some other military units would join him. He expected people to support him, and they chickened out or something. You know, and then he decided he didn't want to die on the outskirts of Moscow, even though there would have been a kind of aesthetic glory to doing that. He didn't want to do that. So he went back, and Putin seemed to almost forgive him. And then people in Moscow started saying, well, how could you forgive him? He was he staged an insurrection. And then, you know, mysteriously his plane crashed. My guess is that the plane crash was organized as a kind of spectacular show by Putin to his critics, which I think are many, in the security apparatus and in the elite and in the leadership, to say, this is what's going to happen to you if you try the same thing. Because Putin is now very paranoid. He rarely lets anyone come near him. You know, he's surrounded by guards all the time. And he's aware that there is dissatisfaction with the war and the way it's going. Essentially, it's not a good sign if your most successful military commander stages an insurrection and then you have to murder him in a plane crash. It doesn't seem like that means that everything's going really well.
Well, it seems very consistent with their history. I mean, in a way, but you're saying that's not good news for Putin. And so I want to kind of figure out the tension here in terms of how this war is going to go. And there's also where Trump fits in this, because remember, we have an election coming up. And what happens if Trump wins? And also, I think people wonder about support for the war, both in the United States and in Europe, because it seems like the pace of the counteroffensive, being slower than we thought, sounds like a long war.
There are several questions there. I mean, one is that, yes, I think, you know, I think Putin is probably waiting for the U.S. election to see who wins. And I think he is assuming, as many assume, that if Trump wins, he will withdraw support from Ukraine. He was certainly no fan of NATO and no fan of Ukraine,
Trump.
Actually,
yeah.
In the past. There is sometimes I think, does Trump really want to preside over some kind of big collapse? Maybe he doesn't, but that's another, that we're too far away to speculate about what that would look like. I would say at the moment, I don't see any sign of the Western coalition breaking or of the Biden administration changing its mind.
No, so, certainly the Biden certainly
until, you know, until the end of 2024, I don't see there any chance that they will stop supporting Ukraine. There's another aspect, though, that I think it's important to understand, which is that even if Biden and the leaders of France and Germany and Britain were to say tomorrow, okay, that's enough of this war. We don't want to do it anymore. Ukraine needs to make a deal. The difficulty is that they don't have anyone to make a deal with, because the Russian goal officially is unchanged. You know, the Russians want to destroy all of Ukraine. You know, they don't think it's a real country. They think they're, you know, it needs to be wiped off the map. They don't think it should exist. They want to destroy it. And so the Ukrainians can't stop fighting because, you know, they can't do a deal with someone who has genocidal intentions towards the entire nation.
Well, let me ask you about that, because when you say destroy Ukraine and genocidal, is it genocidal, or is it he thought he could take over Ukraine and, you know, right away, and then it would just be part of the Soviet Union again, essentially? Because genocide, there are so many Ukrainians being killed, civilians and soldiers, obviously, but there's a temptation to call it genocidal. But that seems like any war in history where someone conquers another country and there's a war and a lot of people end up getting killed, as opposed to Hitler, who identified a group of people and killed them, rounded them up and killed them. So I just want to get the definition of genocidal.
No, I understand. It's a good question. The key is to look at what the Russians do when they occupy a piece of territory in Ukraine. You know, what did they do when they took over Zaporizhia or Kherson, you know, 18 months ago? The first thing they did was they rounded up all of the local leaders. Then they began carrying out mass and random arrests. It became clear pretty fast that what they wanted to do was Russify. So anybody who spoke Ukrainian, anybody who had a Ukrainian, the Ukrainians put these tattoos on their arms, you know, like sheaves of wheat or something. It's a kind of national, it was almost a fashion. Anyone who had a Ukrainian tattoo would be arrested and would be disappeared, you know, maybe murdered. Anyone who had anything to do with Ukrainian administration, as I said, spoke the language, you know. So the idea was to get rid of any vestiges of anything to do with Ukraine in these areas. The other thing they did was they began kidnapping and deporting children. So some of these were children from, you know, orphanages and so on. But the point of it, you know, and the point was is they take the children to Russia and then they Russify them, they change their names, and they give them to Russian families. In other words, the idea is that you want to disappear Ukraine. You want to destroy it as a nation. Whether that's going to require killing every single Ukrainian, you know, maybe, maybe not. But certainly the idea is to eliminate it as an identity or as a nation or as a language or as a remembered history or as a society. And the definition of genocide, actually, this is longer, you know, as it was originally conceived, was about eliminating a people, a nation, a group, you know, through different means. Hitler did it in one way, but the idea is that Putin doesn't think it should exist. There shouldn't be any Ukrainians. It turns out, I think his original assumption was there weren't really any Ukrainians. You know, there were sort of Zelensky and a few guys, and once we could kill them, and then everybody else would turn out to be Russian. And now they're discovering that there are a lot more Ukrainians than they thought. Actually, there's, you know, 30 million of them. And so they are becoming more systematic. They're killing more people, and the lethality of their occupation is much worse than it even was originally. You know, maybe there's a different word you could use that would be less evocative in the Second World War, but it's an attempt to eradicate them as a nation, and that's something that's a little bit more than just. It's not just a territorial war. You know, it's not just about who controls the city, because if the Russians take over the city, you know, they kill everybody there and they torture people and they take the children away. So it's not like the Ukrainians can just say, oh, all right, you can have that city, you know, and it's okay to torture all those people and kill them.
Well, that kind of motivates the Ukrainians,
yes.
You know, and that helps me understand that, because you wonder how long they can do this And if that's the, you know, understanding that, it's as long as they can breathe.
The alternative is that they die under Russian occupation. So, you know, it's not like there's a really good choice. I mean, the thing that could change the war, and, you know, I've written this, you know, a couple of times, but the thing that could change the war is a political change in Russia, by which I don't necessarily mean regime change. But, you know, if the Russians decide that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't worth it, you know, it's draining them too much, that it, you know, I mean, something like the decision the French made about, the French ran this horrible war in Algeria for many years. Uh-huh. Finally, in 1962, they said, we've had enough, we're coming home. And it was a very politically controversial decision. And there was like an attempted coup d'etat in Paris, and somebody tried to kill Charles de Gaulle. And, you know, it was a very emotive moment in French history. You know, but the war ended. And something like that has to happen in Moscow. And all I can say is that when it happens, we'll see it. So when, if there is a change and the Russians say, okay, it's enough, we're leaving, or, you know, it's enough, we're just keeping Crimea, then there is a moment when you could have a negotiation. The trouble with talking about negotiation right now is that we haven't got to that moment yet. So as I said, even if, you know, Biden and Macron and Schultz, you know, all got together and said the Ukrainians have to negotiate, there isn't anything they can negotiate now. There isn't anyone to negotiate with, because Putin hasn't given up the idea of eradicating the country. And they still use this language on Russian television. I mean, even in the last few days, you know, Ukrainianism is a virus and it needs to be stepped out, or the Ukrainians are parasites and they need to be eliminated, or, you know, something, this kind of language that is, you know, it did used to be considered sort of genocidal language. You know, these aren't, they're not human, they're rats, or they're parasites, or they're mice, or,
yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, they're lice. You know, when they begin to stop talking like that, and when they begin calculating rationally, then we can talk about the war ending.
Well, that helps us understand, or my audience and me understand, how the Ukrainians aren't at one point going like, well, we can't win this right away, so let's negotiate.
I mean, you need two sides to negotiate. Yeah, I mean, there have to be two partners to negotiate. That's the main problem. I mean, the other issue is, you know, that you could have a ceasefire, which is what happened in 2014. You know, there was a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine and so on, and you could then police the ceasefire for a while. But the, you know, if the Russians use the ceasefire to rearm and rebuild their missiles, you know, and then to relaunch the war again in 2 years, then I don't think we've achieved very much.
There's no hope for some kind of stasis like that, because
you would have to have this change in Russia. There has to be a change of heart or a change of mind.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Anne Applebaum of the Atlantic Monthly.
Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
We're back with Anne Applebaum of the Atlantic Monthly. Can I ask you, it's a little change of subject, but it's also, I think, about Putin. But you've written about disinformation and fake news. What role has Putin played in that, in the history of that? And talk about fake news for a bit, if you would.
So he played a big role. He and actually Prigozhin played a role. Prigozhin has had a ran something called the Internet Research Agency that was involved in it. You know, it might help to know that some of what we now recognize or we talk about as fake news isn't really new. So in the KGB used to do this. They would, there's a famous story where very well known, very well studied of how they created an international rumor that the CIA had invented AIDS. And they planted it first, I think it was in an Indian newspaper, and then they planted it in an Italian newspaper, and they planted it in different places at different times to create the impression that lots of different people around the world were talking about this idea that the CIA had created AIDS. And this is in the early 80s. And then they produced some kind of fake scientist who gave a press conference in East Germany about how the CIA had invented AIDS. And they succeeded in creating this impression in lots of places, you know, in Malaysia and in parts of Africa that the CIA had created AIDS. And this is how you create the impression of that a fake story is true. Fast forward to, you know, about a decade ago, the Russians worked out that you can still do this same way of creating echo chambers, you know, that create fake news, but you can do it in 10 minutes. So you don't have to, you know, the CIA creating AIDS was a long project, took a couple years. You can now do that by seeding a story. You can do one version on a, you know, on a Russian channel. You can do one on an Asian channel or an African channel. You can get one of your friends in Western Europe or in the United States to echo it. And you can produce a sense that there's a story that's real simply by the large numbers of people repeating it. You can also add completely fake, you know, bots. You know, you can create a bot farms on Twitter, used to be able to do that, or on Facebook. So you can create fake Facebook pages, which also put out this story and try to reach audiences that way. And the echo effect convinces people that it's true. And you can see them doing this all the time. There's a Ukrainian biolab story. You know, the Ukrainians have, you know, labs where they're, their versions of this that happened, you know, they still do it now all the time. Famously, they did a version of this in the 2016 election. And this is the one thing about the Trump-Russia connection that is not disputed. It was proven by Mueller and it was proven by the Senate committee. And it has been lots of evidence, you know, that the Russians did create fake sites and fake narratives in order to convince Americans to vote for Trump.
And that is the Internet Research.
And that was, there was a thing called the Internet Research Agency. It was run by Prigozhin, who we were just talking about.
As funny as that we're talking about it as history, and it's so recent, and it played a role. Mm-hmm. I've had this argument on this podcast, but I do believe that played a role in that election.
Certainly one piece of it. I mean, I think the leaks from the you know, Democratic National Committee were very important, you know, and the way that they were then spun online to, you know, into various conspiracy theories, you know, that was I think that had an impact. Whether, you know, every Facebook post they did mattered or not, you know, they did a lot of anti-immigration groups. They created fake groups. They also created fake black activist groups that were anti-Clinton. So they weren't pro-Trump, but they were anti. They were about how terrible Hillary Clinton is or how racist she is or something like
that. Yeah, super
and,
predators.
You know, and who knows? It's very hard to measure the effect of these kinds of things. But, you know, there was a lot of it. It was seeded all over the country. And it was certainly an attempt to shape our election. And this is very similar to what the Russians have done in other places. And in fact, I had written about it before 2016 as a thing they were doing in Europe. You know, I saw a version of it in Poland. I saw a version of it in Germany. I actually wrote I was involved in a project, a sort of think tank project, that we wrote a paper describing how this works. We took it around Washington, and it was either late 2015 or early 2016. I can't remember. And I have this funny memory of taking it to Capitol Hill and showing it to people. You know, they would say, well, boy, this is terrible. You know, it's really bad that Slovakia is going to have this terrible problem, you know, but it's not really that important and it couldn't affect us. You know? And then in the U.S. election, you know, in this summer and 2016, I started to see it. You know, I thought, oh no, you know, you're joking. You're not going to do that here. And they did. It was exactly what they had done in other places. You know, they support far right candidates. They've supported some far left candidates. They support anybody who seems like a spoiler. You know, anybody anti-NATO, anybody anti the European Union, anybody who is perceived as anti-democratic. Those are the kinds of candidates they supported. And in Trump, they saw as kind of perfect problem creator, and they supported him. And whether Trump knew about it, you know,
that's a great description. of Donald Trump, a perfect problem creator. You
know, he was going to be a problem for American democracy. He was a problem for NATO. He's a problem for American alliances. He was a problem for, you know, I mean, he was perfect for them.
And it's, to me, I'm sorry, I like that so much.
I mean, it's almost immaterial whether Trump knew about it or not. I mean, he clearly guessed it at some, you know, but that's you know, that they did it is not in question.
Oh, I think Stone knew it. And
sure.
He was coordinating, right, with WikiLeaks and stuff.
You know, and Paul Manafort was someone who'd been doing this in Ukraine.
Well, yeah, it worked for them in Ukraine, yeah.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what he was doing.
So let me just get this straight, because this is something you've studied and know, that really the KGB and Putin really sort of started this thing. Is that a true statement?
I would say I would make it a little more nuanced. You know, some of what they
no,
do.
No, no, no. It's got to be.
You
either.
Don't want to be nuanced.
No, no. Nuance it. Go nuance it. That's what you're doing.
Some of what they were doing was using tactics already used by American PR companies. So I think what the Russians and they it was sort of the old.
Wait a minute. American PR.
So meaning that they worked at, you know, they worked at how do you use Facebook to spread messages, right? So that was something that.
But I'm talking about the early 80s. So I'm talking
the early 80s. Absolutely. I thought you were talking about recently. No, the early 80s. They invented that idea. Yes.
So in other words, that's what I was getting
at. That way of doing it, they invented it. I mean, everybody did propaganda and everybody did, you know, that kind of thing. But that particular format of seeking to create a story through a process of repetition and so on, I think they invented that, yes.
And did they deliberately go to, you know, Malaysia or wherever these other countries, they seeded these things in India or where they did, not the United States? Was it deliberate that they did that?
Yes, I think because their aim at that time was, you know, as now, was creating friends in, you know, in the non-Western world. That was one of their, but also the aim was, if the story is coming from several different directions at once, then it has more credibility. So if you hear it in this paper and that paper, and they seem to have nothing to do with each other, then that adds the credibility.
And that's why I'm asking, is this sort of the genesis of fake news? Is it fair to say that, yes, people have done propaganda forever?
Yes. I mean, this particular way of doing it, I think they invented it, yes.
Because to me, it's destroyed a lot and made our politics just almost impossible, because remember Kellyanne Conway saying there are going to be alternative facts. And when she said that, I think a lot of Americans, me included, went, okay, that's just ridiculous. And what we didn't understand was the rationale for that was, well, there's fake news. And fake news puts out fake facts. So we need alternative facts to counter the fake news and the fake facts. And therefore, a lot of Americans are going, I guess there just aren't any facts anymore.
It's unbelievably damaging for democracy, because democracy is really about, you know, you argue over an agreed upon set of issues, right? You know, you have a discussion of what happened yesterday and, you know, and how we should react to it. If people don't agree about what happened yesterday, then you can't discuss it, you can't debate it, you can't pass a law about it, you can't fix it. And so it's been profoundly damaging that we no longer agree on the nature of reality, which I think is fair to say we don't. And that is something that would be, you know, from the Russian point of view, positive that Americans don't agree on reality, I think is also pretty clear.
So Putin can take a bit of, can take some pride in this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give him all the credit. I mean, there were plenty of Americans working pretty hard to create this also. So I'm not telling they achieved this amazing thing, but.
But he can't go like, I started it.
Well, I don't know. Maybe in the private field, one of his gold palaces, he does that. I don't know.
Well, I'm not. Yeah. But I just wanted to get that history from you because this is something, among other things, that you seem that you are an expert on. And I can't tell you. Thank you for doing this. I think we've talked about the future of the war, which is we don't know, but I think we understand now why Ukrainians will just keep fighting, because it is their survival, their very survival.
So one of them, somebody said to me when I was there last week, and he said, you know, what if the Americans won't give us weapons, then we're going to go and get weapons from, you know, South Korea or India. And if they won't give us weapons, we're going to, you know, pick up sticks and stones, is what he said.
Yeah. We will kill them with axe.
Yes.
That's not a good Ukrainian accent, was it? Does that sound Ukrainian?
Not really. Know. Sorry.
What's a good Ukrainian name? What's a first name for a Ukrainian?
I don't know.
A male.
Mikhailo, Serhii, you know.
Serhii.
Yeah.
We will, here is the axe. Okay. We just kill them. Okay. So we don't need this Starlink to do that. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.